We are live.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order today, January 3rd, the day after Groundhog's Day. And we will have one item on our schedule today. And so I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 137. Chris or whoever is summarizing this.
Did you want to take roll, Madam Chair?
Oh, shoot. I've got to have a list on my computer. Don't forget to take roll. Okay, please take the roll.
Senator Findley?
Present by video.
Senator Riley?
Present by video.
Senator Wagner? Vice Chair Boquist?
Senator Boquist, present by audio.
Madam Chair Burdick?
Present by video. Thank you for your indulgence. Now we will really open a public hearing on Senate Bill 137. Chris.
Hey, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 137 is your usual reconnect bill, and Kyle and Kate are here. Kyle is going to walk you through that, and then there's some examples that I think Kyle and Kate Harger is going to walk through. And just so you're aware, Kate Toswell from LC is also in the group, just in case any questions go down the legal path.
Okay, thank you, Kate Toswell, for joining us. Okay, Kyle, did you want to go first?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, Chris just mentioned the Senate Bill 137, and we do have a dash one amendment, which I'll get to as well. but Senate Bill 137 is the annual reconnect bill that the revenue committees will generally see each legislative session. So just to try to set up the discussion here, the reconnect bill, so Oregon, you can kind of think of Oregon's connection to federal tax law in almost two buckets, where the first one is Oregon is connected. We have a what's considered a rolling reconnect, and that has to do with the connection to the federal definition of taxable income. So Oregon's tax system starts from that federal definition of taxable income, and then it Oregon's system then filters the, or follows from there. So any changes at the federal level that are that affect the change in federal taxable income will automatically impact or potentially impact Oregon's taxes as well, our tax system. And that's where it's referred to the rolling reconnect, because it's automatically there as of the way the law is set up right now. So changes at the federal level automatically flow through to Oregon. And then the second bucket, if you will, in how Oregon connects to federal tax law are these individual point-in-time connections. And this is anything that's not related to federal taxable income. And that's what most of the bill that you have in front of you in Senate Bill 137 relates to, those point-in-time connections. And so a way to think of it is really these point-in-time connections are almost like Oregon is pointing to the Internal Revenue Code as of a specific date. In many cases, this is going to be December 31st of, right now, 2018. So if you think about, if you printed out the IRC as of December 31st, 2018, and IRC, the Internal Revenue Code, those are the point-in-time connections Oregon is connected to. What you have in Senate Bill 137 is moving that connection date up to December 31st, in most cases, December 31st, 2020. And so then you could just print out the Internal Revenue Code as of that date, and that would give you your point-in-time connections there. But there's really two ways in which we're connected. And you heard some of this background as well from the CPAs yesterday and their testimony of how change at the federal level flow through here to Oregon. So in terms of Senate Bill 137, again, the reconnect bill from last year, we are moving from 2018 in many cases, December 31st, 2018, to December 31st, 2020. And this reflects last year, there wasn't a reconnect bill that was enacted. So it is a kind of a two-year move of that point-in-time connection in Senate Bill 137. Additionally, there is the Dash 1 amendment. I should note, in the meeting materials on OLIS, there's also a section-by-section description of the bill, as there are a lot of sections in this bill that are pointing to different references at the federal level to update that date. So if you want to see kind of the section by section description of what those are pointing to, that is in the meeting materials. But the Dash 1 amendment, this relates to relatively recent changes that occurred in 2020 related to the CARES Act. and the potential for Oregon to disconnect from those changes. So there's certain policies, and we have some examples on these that we'll get into, where there was a change made at the federal level because of Oregon's connection to federal taxable income. That change filtered through to Oregon's tax system automatically. And so for Oregon to not adopt that change, it more or less requires a disconnect from that federal tax law. And in many cases, that manifests itself as an Oregon addition. So that's the language you'll generally see in the Dash 1 amendment, is an addition here in Oregon related to an amount taken at the federal level. But again, there's three provisions in the Dash 1 amendment. We'll go through them individually if it's okay with you, Madam Chair. We do have some examples that are illustrative examples. They're oversimplified, but to give a sense of how this disconnect would function.
Senator Finley has his hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Kyle. I have a quick question. If we decide to disconnect from the federal tax code, it would be basically in effect raising additional revenue by disallowing a deduction. So does that require 3/5 vote for those measures? Because it's essentially a tax increase.
We have Kate Toswell on board here, probably the best person to answer that. Kate, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hello, this is Kate Toswell. excuse me, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, and Senator Finley. That is a good question. I think the disconnections that we're talking about in terms of the CARES Act, they do look like they would bring revenue into the Treasury. But what we need to look at further is our evolving understanding of what it means to be a bill for raising revenue. And in the case law that we've had basically over the past 5 years, starting with the case, the Oregon Supreme Court case, City of Seattle, our understanding of what it means to be a bill for raising revenue has evolved. Not to go into a lot of legal detail, but essentially that case in 2015 gave us more information about how the case Bobo versus Kulongoski, which is from the 90s, how that case needs to be interpreted. And what the Oregon Supreme Court has told us is that in addition to bringing revenue into the state treasury, increasing revenue, for a bill to be a bill for raising revenue and therefore to require 3/5 and also under the origination clause to be required to be a House bill, it would also need to have the essential features of a bill levying a tax. And so there are a number of bills that we see within the past few years that don't appear under the analysis of the Oregon Supreme Court to be bills for raising revenue, even if they are bills that without our understanding from that case, we might have thought this needs to go in the title. One other piece is what we put in the title in terms of whether we include raises revenue and requires a 3/5 majority is essentially, that's a determination that we're making in legislative council. That doesn't have legal effect. And so in other words, even if we don't include that in the title, if a bill gets a supermajority of more than 3/5 or more, then there's no ability to review it. So in other words, whether it was correct or not to have it in the title is never, we never get to hear, you know, is that something that a court is going to decide? In looking at these provisions, at least the provisions that are in the Dash 1 amendment, I think it's good to actually look closely at City of Seattle. And in that case, the Oregon Supreme Court said, this isn't a bill that has the features, essential features of a bill that levies a tax. It's a bill that's repealing an exemption. And even if when you repeal an exemption, there will be taxpayers that are paying more, that is not the essential features of a bill levying a tax. And so I think that is the framework that we look at in 2021, in the present day, that's what we're going to look at. So our understanding is most likely not.
Okay,
if that is helpful.
So bottom line, this is not a 3/5. The Dash 1 amendment would not trigger a 3/5 vote, and it would be within the jurisdiction of the Senate to originate it.
Chair Burdick, that is my understanding. Again, looking back at City of Seattle, when you repeal a tax exemption, and this is somewhat more involved than that. It isn't necessarily repealing it. It's repealing a limitation in one case, but it is affecting things that are deductions. Yes, it's accurate to say doesn't require a supermajority and doesn't have the origination clause requirement that it be a House bill.
Okay, does that answer your question, Senator Finley?
Madam Chair, it does. I think that the people that were going to have to write a check because their tax debt will go up would disagree with that. I mean, the bottom line is that they're going to be paying more money as a result of this measure, that they would argue that it is a tax increase. But thank you. You answered my question.
Thank you. And
thank you.
We have been joined by Senator Wagner. Wagner, should we just have him say he's joining by video? Senator Wagner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wagner joining by video.
Thank you. Okay. Senator Boquist, did you have a question? I see your little light blinking.
Yeah, my light is blinking. So I have a follow-up question for Kyle and for Kate, but if they're going to cover it later, they can do it. But I'd like to state my follow-up question.
Okay, please state it, and then I'll let them decide if that's going to be talked about later. Go ahead.
Thank you. I mean, Kate outlined, thanks, Kate, for not mentioning my own case, too, where we got hammered. So I appreciate that. That's a good thing. That being said, though, I do look at this from a different constitutional point of view, and I'm looking for either Kyle to explain its meaning later, and then you answer, or you can jump in now, and maybe Kyle will do it later. But the Dash 1 amendment is going to affect retroactive 3 years. I mean, we're going to change the tax law going back 3 years and then require probably hundreds of thousands of people to do multiple amended returns. I think you call it ex post facto or something going backwards 3 years. So maybe Kyle could explain those dates and whether it really does go back 3 years, and then maybe a legal interpretation of how we, the present legislature, is going to go back and change the laws from two legislative sessions before us. Thank you.
Okay, Kyle, how would you like to respond to that?
Yes, Madam Chair, we do have, in the examples we can go through, we'll kind of explain how this works and what tax year it applies to, and it's kind of the way it functions in terms of retroactivity. So if it's okay, I think we could actually answer this question in the reverse order, where Kate may be able to address the legal implications of a retroactivity. And then I think as we kind of go through each of the three policies of the disconnect, I think that's made apparent in the examples that we have. So it may be easier to answer that question then as we're working through the examples we have in OLIS.
Okay. Are you comfortable with that, Senator Boquist? We'll just proceed.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Proceed.
Hi. Should I go ahead? This is Kate again.
Kyle, do you think it's more appropriate for Kate to jump in when we reach that point or now? Your call.
I think it's fine if Kate wants to jump in now, because I think it doesn't pertain to setting up the example. It could be easier to do it at this time.
Okay, go ahead, Kate. Thank you.
Okay, Chair Burdick, Senator Boquist, members of the committee, this question of making retroactive changes is definitely something that has come up and we've talked about. That is something that under the law generally is feasible, is possible. The legislature can go back and can affect tax law in what we view as a retroactive sense. It's good to remember that tax law generally deals in applicability, and applicability as applied to tax years, but certainly changes that the legislature would make that would require amended returns going back. So say right now it's 2021 and we're looking at the 2020 tax year in terms of what people are filing. Anything that's earlier than that, people are typically going to have to file an amended return if there is a change that's made. There is case law, including U.S. Supreme Court case law, that supports the idea that legislatures can make those changes. There is no And there have been different theories that have been raised as to why that wouldn't be appropriate, whether it's illegal takings or whether there's some sort of contract problem. And what we consistently have seen is it is okay for the legislature to make retroactive changes. That said, there may be a limit going back a number of years where there is a due process problem. But I think that's probably, that's many years. And I think before you would reach a legal obstacle with that point, there might actually be more of an administrative problem. I think there is probably a point where it's too far back and it's administratively not feasible to make those changes. But as far as legal barriers, the legislature does have the power to tax, the power to make modifications, and also the ability to make what we see as retroactive changes to the tax laws.
Thank you, Kate. Does that satisfy your question, Senator Boquist?
No, madam, we're gonna need a formal legal opinion here because you and I, this is not our first rodeo, and we've gone back quite a ways before, but if Kyle, I think the best thing is for Kyle to go through these examples and explain them so we can understand, because even the Supreme Court case doesn't go back 3 to 4 years. So I'm familiar with that case, so therefore.
Okay, let's proceed then, and maybe we'll get some clarification. So go ahead, Kyle. Thank you, Kate.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, so the three provisions we're gonna walk through here are federal provisions of the CARES Act that were enacted this past 2020. And part of the retroactivity, and we'll be sure to highlight this as we work through the examples, does stem from the fact that the federal tax changes in part were retroactive. So the CARES Act put in place, in some cases, changes that would affect tax year 2020, and they did this in 2020, but they also look back to 2019 and even in some cases, tax year 2018. So the federal law itself had some retroactivity provisions as well, but that's just to set up the discussion that will ensue here. But what we have is the three provisions. The first one is related to a limitation on business interest deductibility. The second has to do with net operating losses and carrybacks. And the final one that we'll discuss is the business loss limitation. So it's a limitation on business losses offsetting other types of income. So I think our plan is just to step through those three. I'm gonna hand things off to Caitlin Harder, an LRO, to start off with the business interest deduction, then I'll pick things up after that with some of the NOLs and the business loss limitation. And these examples, again, I'll get this pulled up, I'll share my screen here in a moment, but we'll be working from the examples in the meeting materials. They're titled the Dash One Amendment Examples. So it'll be, it's like a 6-page document, we'll just be scrolling through that. So if people wanna follow along, from there as well, but I'll see if I can get that pulled up here as Caitlin comes in.
That sounds good, and thank you, Kyle, for handing things off to me. So just for the record, while Kyle gets that pulled up, I am Caitlin Harger from the Legislative Revenue Office. And like Kyle mentioned today, we're going to start by talking through some examples that reflect the Dash One Amendment. These are also related to some of the provisions and materials discussed in our CARES Act report over the interim. And so some of you might be a little bit familiar with these already. Kyle, thanks for pulling that up. So I'm gonna start by talking about the business interest deduction limitation. And so in general, this is a limit on the amount of interest a business can deduct as an expense in any specific tax year. Prior to the CARES Act, that limit was equal to 30% of a company's adjusted taxable income. And the CARES Act made a change which effectively raised that limit to 50% of that income threshold. And so any interest that is not used or any excess interest above that limit in the first year can be passed forward into other years via a carry forward. So I'll show an example with numbers on the next slide, but for now I wanted you to just have a chance to visualize the difference here. And also a reminder that this provision, the business interest deduction limitation, applies only to businesses with over $25 million in U.S. receipts within a specific tax year. And so Kyle, if you could go to the next page, I will start talking through this example. So there are a lot of numbers here. I'll try to go through this quickly, but of course, stop me or ask for additional detail if anything's unclear. So here I've got a table that shows three different policy scenarios and the net effects from each. So starting at the very top, I've highlighted here in this orange color that this is the pre-CARES Act world. So before the CARES Act was passed, this business interest deduction limit was at 30% of ATI. And so I've just made up an example. These numbers are in millions of dollars, but again, completely hypothetical just for conceptualizing this. So suppose we have a company whose total income is $100 million in 2020. And suppose that during 2020, the business interest that they could potentially deduct or that they've spent is $60 million. Okay, so they have $100 million in income, then they have this $60 million potential interest expense. So federal law says, pre-CARES, the most interest that you can deduct in this tax year would be 30% of that total income number. So 30% of 110 gets us to that first 33, the 33 million there. That's the maximum they can take. Now in reality, they had 60 million in interest expense. So they can only take 33 of that. And that means they will carry the rest of that forward. So if we take 60, they can claim 33 this tax period. And then in the following period, we get to that 27, which is what's left over. So that is commonly referred to as the excess business interest that isn't able to be deducted during that time period. So that in 2020, that would leave this company with $77 million in income after we take away that $33 million for interest deduction from the 110. And then I'm just applying Oregon rates here. We've got Oregon and federal rates. So the federal rate is 21% for C corporations. And the effective rate that we use in our modeling for Oregon is 7.3. And so that's how we get the 16.2 million and the 5.6 in federal and Oregon tax due. So main takeaway from just the things I've discussed so far, the maximum business interest deduction allowed is 30% of total income in the pre-CARES world, and anything outside of that gets carried forward into the next year. So like I said a few minutes ago, there's this $27 million that they weren't able to deduct in 2020. That shows up in the next column to the right as what they take in 2021. So in 2021, they're able to deduct that additional interest that was too much interest for the 2020 deduction. They take that deduction and then the rates follow through. And so if we look at our totals, which will be important when we're comparing later, the totals at the bottom right cells here show that they would have a $33.6 million federal tax liability and an $11.7 million Oregon tax liability. So that's the pre-CARES world. The next chart that has the green heading, I'm going to go through the same type of example in a post-CARES world. So that would be current law. Remember that the CARES Act changed that limit from 30% up to 50%. So effectively, the only change we'll see here is in that threshold. So again, suppose that this business has $110 million of income. They have $60 million in business interest deductible, potentially. However, we're capping that at 50%. So 50% of the 110 gets us to a maximum deduction here of $55 million. And so the business here can take at most $55 million, but because they had 60, that leaves an extra $5 million for carry forward interest in the later periods. So they take that five and it's carried forward over into the 2021 column as the bid taken there, where Kyle's scrolling. And so the important thing here from this green section of the chart is the limit was increased to 50%. But if you look down at the bottom right-hand cells again within this chart, we can see that the totals are exactly the same as pre-CARES. And so what happens here is that changing this limit changes the timing of the tax liability, but in total, when taken to, when all the excess interest has been accounted for on the return, this evens out. So it's more of a timing shift of revenue or liability rather than an actual change in revenue that you might be familiar with. And this next, the next chart here with the light gray heading with the blue arrow is pointing to is just reemphasizing that point that this is shifting revenue over time rather than representing a revenue change entirely. Okay, so just to summarize before we talk about what's happening in the dash one. Pre-CARES Act, we had a 30% business interest deduction limitation. CARES Act moved that to 50%. So now we'll talk about what the dash one would do. The dash one would require any interest the taxpayer was able to deduct that's above the 30% limit, because that's the pre-CARES. So anything above 30%, we would require an add back or an addition to the return. So looking at this yellow headed chart that Kyle has pulled up, same example as before, at the federal level, under current law, we have total income, let's say of $110 million, $60 million in interest. Remember, those are the numbers that I chose as an example for this, for these purposes. The maximum deduction allowed at the federal level under current law is 50% of that total income number, which gets us to the 55. And just like before, if we have 55 as our maximum, but we had 60 million in interest, then we have 5 million that will carry forward. So federal level, everything stays the same. Now, if we require in Oregon residents to add back that excess interest, that's what I have in bold on this chart. So in Oregon, the maximum we will allow is 30% of that total income number, which was 110. So if at the federal level, I was able to take 55 million as my deduction, but Oregon's only allowing me to take 33 million. That means my addition to my Oregon return is this 22 million. And that's where the that blue arrow is referencing. So Oregon would require an addition to my return of the excess above 30%, which is that 22 million. And then in a subsequent period, from our conversations with the Department of Revenue, the taxpayer would be allowed an adjustment or a subtraction for that 22, which is shown directly to the right in the negative 22 under 2021. So again, I'll draw your attention to the very last chart on the bottom right, which shows in that blue circle that the total is unchanged. We're expecting this to be a timing shift on revenue so that there is less tax currently for this individual, but more tax later. And again, this is a timing shift and not a revenue change. And
okay, so, Caitlin, under existing law, how long do companies have to carry forward? How many tax years can they carry this forward?
So Chair Verdict, I believe that they can carry this interest forward indefinitely. And some companies will continue accruing interest on a pretty regular basis, whereas other companies might have one period where they have a large amount of interest and then they're just carrying forward what's left from that limit. But I do believe it's an indefinite amount to carry forward. I will double check though and get back.
Even if companies have business interest liabilities, you know, every year, eventually, yes, it comes out in the wash. Eventually, it is revenue neutral.
Yes, yes, that's our understanding, and with our in our conversations with the Department of Revenue, that's been their understanding thus far as well.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, so I think that concludes the business interest deduction limitation portion. Unless there are other questions, which I'm happy to take, but if not, then I think Kyle will pick up with the next example.
Okay, I see no questions, so Kyle, go ahead.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, once again, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, so the next provision that I have for you is relating to the net operating losses and a carryback provision. So I'll try to follow the same approach that Kate just went to in explaining kind of pre-CARES Act, current loss, that's after the CARES Act, and then what a disconnect would look like. And the idea here is to try to set up so that everyone can understand sort of the benefit that came from the CARES Act and give some sense of why the CARES Act policy was probably enacted in the first place. See if I can make this a little bit bigger. So in terms of the net operating loss, Again, the example here, it's oversimplified, and it's intended to be for conceptual understanding. It's only kind of an example of one taxpayer, and there can be a lot of differences depending on taxpayer specifics, but hopefully it just helps with the general understanding. But a net operating loss, the way this works is you're going to have a taxpayer who will have business income, or in this case, a business loss. So the income didn't, or the business, excuse me, didn't make a profit this year. It actually had a net loss. And so the example I have here is just a simple, a taxpayer that has, let's say, wages of $50,000, and then they have a business income, in this case, of negative $100,000. So this is a business loss to the taxpayer of $100,000. So from a net perspective, positive $50,000 in wages, negative $100,000 in business income will net to a negative $50,000 essentially in adjusted gross income, or AGI. Now, for in this case, that would create a net operating loss of $50,000, right? So it basically will zero out your AGI, and then you have that $50,000 you can then apply to another tax year to offset income in a next year when perhaps you have income to offset. And that's the way an NOL works, is pre-CARES Act. And the CARES Act in this case relates to three tax years, 2018, 2019, and 2020. So that's the example I have here is pre-CARES Act, if you created a net operating loss in one of these tax years, you would carry that forward and use it in a subsequent year when you had sufficient income to do that. So a NOL created in 2018 would be carried forward and you could use it in 2019, 2020, 2021, what have you. And it's an indefinite carry forward. So basically the taxpayer has that until they can use that up. And that's the same case for 2018, 2019, and 2020. Now the current law, and this was put in place by the CARES Act, the CARES Act specifically said, okay, for tax years 2018, 2019, and 2020, you can still carry those net operating losses that originated in any of those three tax years forward. So that's still available. But the change here is allowing a taxpayer to carry those losses back up to 5 years to a previous tax year. And again, this law, the CARES Act, was passed in 2020, but it related to net operating losses that originated in 18, 19, or 20. And that's where part of the CARES Act made this retroactive change as well. But so for a taxpayer who had a loss in, let's say, 2018, instead of having to wait to carry that forward, they could amend a previous year's return. So going back as far as 5 years, they could amend their 2013 tax return to use that net operating loss as if it occurred in 2013 and more or less monetize the benefit of that net operating loss as soon as they amend that return. So rather than carrying it forward and getting the tax benefit then, the taxpayer amends and more quickly, or the idea behind it would be the taxpayer more quickly gets that benefit of that net operating loss. So it could increase cash flow from a taxpayer perspective where otherwise they might have to wait until the following tax year or maybe a few years down the road, depending upon their individual tax situation. But so that's the benefit, if you will, of the CARES Act, is just allowing those losses to be carried back. In terms of effect on revenue streams, this only matters if a taxpayer does carry it back. If a taxpayer just carries it forward as normal, that doesn't really change anything because that's the current law. So it really is, it would take the taxpayer to actually carry this back to then have an effect on Oregon's revenue streams in this case. So that's the conceptual idea. I do have some tables here. I'll try to move through these fairly quickly, as it's just kind of an example to support that example I just put ahead of time that was just more related to how this would work. But in terms of putting dollars to the previous example, let's say a taxpayer previous to the CARES Act had a net operating loss of $50,000. They then carry that forward. In this example, we're saying they're just carrying it forward over the next 5 years. So they use $10,000 in each of the next five tax years, and they receive that benefit in the form of reducing their income in those tax years. So they get a net tax benefit in that way. And again, these are just kind of generic tax rates to just give some sense, but you can see, okay, the taxpayer receives a benefit over the next 5 years of $16,750 in this example, as they use that net operating loss up in the subsequent tax years. Now, current law for the CARES Act here, assuming this taxpayer does have liability in a previous tax year, they carry this net operating loss back. So this $50,000, instead of being spread out over the next 5 years, goes back to a tax year pre-2020. So they amend a tax return and they get that benefit more quickly. So they still get that same amount. There could be some differences based upon tax rates and stuff, but just conceptually, they still get the same benefit and they just get it sooner. Rather than being spread out over 5 years, they get it as soon as they can get their returns amended for the previous tax years. So that's the benefit to the taxpayer there. In terms of a disconnect, how this would work is Oregon would require an addition in the instance when a taxpayer does carry a net operating loss back. So for taxpayers that don't carry a loss back, there is no change from a disconnect. But for a taxpayer that does carry this back, they still get the benefit at the federal level, $12,500 in this case, and then Oregon would say, okay, you're gonna add that loss you carried back, add that back. So we're gonna more or less disconnect from the ability to carry back a loss for Oregon purposes. So the taxpayer can carry back on their federal return, and then on their Oregon return, they once again have to carry that loss forward. So from the taxpayer perspective, the net benefit is still the same. It's just the timing of that. So for federal, carry it back, get it as soon as they amend their return. Oregon, they take it over the preceding tax years or the subsequent tax years. So it just shifts when that benefit would occur to the taxpayer. And of course, this then would filter into Oregon's revenue streams, where a disconnect would then avoid, in some cases, a loss in revenue in the near term, but then would push that loss out in the later years. So again, you'd kind of see this balance out over the long term. And then the final table here is just underscoring, I guess, the comparison between those three, but the upshot, if you will, of this final comparison is just showing the taxpayer can still carry their loss back federally, but for Oregon, they would then have to carry it forward through our requirement of an addition. So it would change the benefit stream at the federal level and at the Oregon level for the taxpayer. And I can pause here for a moment before I move on to the third provision.
Okay, we have a question, Senator Finley.
I do, Madam Chair, thank you. Before I get really wrapped around the axles on this, do we know how many taxpayers in Oregon filed and carried their net operating loss back? Do we have any idea what those numbers are, what those impacts are?
Yeah, Senator Finley, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but yeah, that is one of the things we've been looking at in our estimates for this of the potential effect, is trying to glean some information from past years. If we go back a few years, taxpayers could carry back losses for a couple years. If we go back to say 17 or 16 before the Tax Cut and Jobs Act at the federal level. So we're trying to glean some information from what we can there. And then also trying to watch as best as we can of the data coming in of how taxpayers are responding to this. But yes, the answer to your question is yes, we do have that information. I don't have it in front of me right now or included in the meeting materials, but I can get you some more information on what we've seen to date and what we've seen in the past. Because it's for the amount of taxpayers that actually have a potential or have a net operating loss and have the potential to carry this back, from what we've seen historically, not a great amount of taxpayers take advantage of that or have historically. Now, again, that could be a little different in this present situation as cash flow could be of more interest to taxpayers. And that's where we're trying to watch what's happening in real time as those start to come in. But yes, can get you a little more information on that to help, give you kind of a scale of where we're at with that.
So thank you, Madam Chair. A comment, I think it would be worthwhile to have exactly how many taxpayers it affects and how many dollars we're talking about before we can move very far forward on that part of it. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Finley. Okay, go ahead, Kyle.
Madam Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Kyle, could you clarify, let me step back because you recall the previous presentation on business interest deductions. That's got a threshold of $25 million. In the example of net operating loss, along the lines of what Senator Finley was talking about, in the law, is there a threshold or anything of that that's in the law that in the, I guess, Post-CARES Act law in which this is, you know, this
particular, I'm going to call it what it is, gimmick, right, because it's revenue neutral. Is this gimmick restricted to certain entities or certain NAAQS codes or anything along that line or certain thresholds that you know of? Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Boquist, no. In terms of the taxpayer, it's going to be up to the individual taxpayer on whether they can take advantage of it. If they have an NOL and the ability to carry it back, they can choose to do so if they would like. But it's going to be up to the individual taxpayer. But you basically, if you have a net operating loss, you have the potential to use this policy.
Okay. Senator Finley, if you could put your hand down so I can tell if you've got a fresh question. Thank you. Okay, go ahead, Kyle.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
No problem.
Okay, so then moving on to the final of the three policies here in the dash one and related to the CARES Act, the next one is related to the business loss limitation. So this in some ways has some similar flavor to the example that Kate gave earlier related to business interest deduction in that it's related to a limit. So for certain business losses that are in this, I should mention the net operating loss and the business loss limitation is specific to personal income taxpayers. So it doesn't affect the corporate income tax system. So specific to personal income taxpayers, those that have a non-corporate business loss in excess of either $250,000 for a single or $500,000 for a joint filer, their losses are limited to that $250,000 or $500,000. And when I say the loss is limited, it's the ability to use that loss to offset other non-business income. So the examples I have here, again, we'll start with a pre-CARES Act to get a sense of sort of the benefit that came from the CARES Act. You have a joint taxpayer, and they have non-business income in this case of $1.5 million. They have business income, or in this case, a business loss of $800,000, so negative $800,000 in business income. Because they reached the limit, their $800,000 is over the $500,000 limit, the actual amount they can use to offset their non-business income is that $500,000. So $1.5 million minus the $500,000 puts them at a net income, in this case, of $1 million. Now that $300,000 in loss, the $800,000 in actual loss compared to the $500,000 in loss they can actually use doesn't go away. It becomes a net operating loss, an NOL that then they can use to carry forward or even carry back if the law allowed it in this case. So in the terms of a taxpayer, it's kind of an immediate limit on that loss and how it can offset income, but they don't lose that loss. They can just use it in another tax year. So under current law, under the CARES Act, we'll use the same example. Non-business income is, again, $1.5 million. Business loss, in this case, is the negative $800,000, and they can use the full amount. So the CARES Act, what it did is just remove these business loss limitations for tax years 2018, tax years 19, and tax year 20. So instead of being limited to a negative $500,000, they can use the full negative $800,000 in business loss. And that brings their net income, the taxpayer in this case, to $700,000. So they get that additional $300,000 in loss. They don't create an NOL in this case because they use the full amount of the loss in the present tax year. And so the benefit there is really that additional $300,000 in loss not being applied against the income tax rates. So again, using generic tax rates, federal benefit would be $75,000. It's the value of this $300,000 times the federal tax rate, in this case, 25%. And the Oregon tax benefit is the same thing, the $300,000 times the Oregon tax rate. So the net benefit to the taxpayer then is about $100,000 in this immediate year. Now, again, pre-CARES Act, they would just create an NOL and carry that forward. But right now, the taxpayer, great, they get their benefit in this tax year. So it's an immediate benefit to the taxpayer. And you could think of it as an immediate loss in revenue then to the state or the federal government in the near term. So an Oregon disconnect would require an add back, an addition in this case. So I split it in this case into two columns where you have the federal, which looks exactly like the previous example, no change at the federal level. So 1.5 million, they can use the full 800,000 in loss, their net income 700,000. So they still get their federal benefit of the 75,000 reduction in tax in the near term. Oregon will then require the addition back of that 300,000 and effectively put the limit back in place. So Oregon says, okay, you have business losses of 800,000, but we're only going to allow 500,000 to be used in this tax year. So your income, once again, is that $1 million. And again, you create that, the taxpayer creates the 300,000 NOL. So the taxpayer, in effect, would lose the benefit of the 25,500 in Oregon. So they don't get any benefit because the limit is reimposed here in Oregon. But they do get this 300,000 in NOL that they would then carry to a subsequent tax year, for example, purposes. So they would get that benefit maybe the next year, maybe 2 years down the road, something along those lines. But they can carry it forward until they can use that up.
But Kyle, in that scenario, they wouldn't be able to put that $300,000 into the previous NOL provision, which allows them to get reimbursed immediately?
Yes, Madam Chair. That's, I guess, an important piece here is if Oregon was looking to do a disconnect, if Oregon disconnected from just this business loss limitation and not the NOL carryback provision, then yes, this taxpayer could do exactly what you just said, where, well, great, I just created a net operating loss. Okay, I'll just carry it back to a previous tax year. And that's where these two provisions kind of work in tandem. Mm-hmm. So if you want to kind of sever or see the benefit in the near term of this revenue, you wouldn't want to allow an individual to carry this loss back immediately. At the very least, you want them to carry it forward to push that at least a year out.
Okay. Is that it?
Okay, Madam Chair, yes. These are the examples we have related to the dash one. I would just note, and we don't need to go through it because I know we've stepped through a lot of examples here. We did include one other thing in the meeting materials related to the Paycheck Protection Program. And that came about in part of the discussion the committee had yesterday with the CPAs. But again, I just wanted to call attention to it for now because I know we've spent quite a bit of time already stepping through these examples.
Okay, why don't we hold off on that because we have witnesses signed up on this issue. Let me ask you one question. If we were going to, you said that it wouldn't make sense to sever the business loss limitation and the net operating losses connections because they're interrelated. Would it work to sever out the business interest deduction limitation?
Yes, Madam Chair, that one doesn't connect the same way. Yeah. So the other two are definitely there's a lot more interconnection too with the latter two that we just presented on.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions from the committee before we get to our witnesses? Okay, I see none. So I will call on Scott Bruhn.
All right. Madam Chair, am I seen?
You're seen. You're seen.
Thank you. Hey, good afternoon, Madam Chair of Committee. My name is Scott Bruhn. I am the fairly new Tax and Fiscal Policy Director for OBI, Oregon Business and Industry. Or OBI is the state's largest business trade association. We have about 1,600 members, and those 1,600 members, member businesses employ about 330,000 Oregonians. And Madam Chair, I'm actually speaking today to the Dash 1 amendments, not the bill, if that's okay.
That is desirable. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So, Madam Chair, Committee, OBI, just to lay it out there, OBI strongly opposes disconnection from the federal tax code, especially efforts to disconnect from the bipartisan Federal CARES Act and the critical benefits the CARES Act provided struggling businesses, as the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 137 would do. Every business in the state of Oregon has been affected by the economic fallout caused by that pandemic. Work slowed down. Work was sidelined, work went away. And sadly, at the worst, many businesses have simply had to close and will not be coming back. At the peak of all of this, back in April of last year, there were nearly 300,000 Oregonians out of work due to the pandemic and the business slowdowns or mandated closures. The business aspects of the CARES Act were passed on a bipartisan basis to help businesses weather the storm. It was designed on a bipartisan basis to give businesses a little bit of time to get on their feet, to provide the liquidity to stay open and keep people employed. Part of this means allowing businesses that have losses, especially losses related to COVID, the tax benefit of those losses. Some are calling those CARES Act loss benefits a loophole. Well, Madam Chair, it's emphatically not a loophole, it is a lifeline. By definition, if you are a business that is losing money, you likely don't have the liquidity or cash to sustain operations and keep people employed. The loss benefits of the CARES Act at least allows additional liquidity to sustain operations for a time, time to get back on their feet until this crisis is behind us. The Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 137 would raise business taxes at a time when businesses are struggling. But we think it's very important for the committee to fully understand exactly which businesses this amendment raises taxes on. It raises taxes on those very businesses that have struggled the most and have had the hardest time during the crisis. The businesses that have lost and are losing money, including the businesses like gyms and restaurants who are mandated to close and lose money out of public safety and health concerns. And Madam Chair, let me just wrap this up by mentioning a conversation I had just this week with a little gym that I go to. It's a two-person husband and wife sort of deal. They're a franchisee of a larger organization. They've been forced to close basically 5 or 6 months out of the last 12. They're going to have losses. They weren't allowed to collect any income at all, yet their expenses, including the biggest one, their rent, never went away. They're going to be in a loss situation for a while, and the CARES Act is exactly, that kind of business is exactly what the CARES Act was designed to help. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sorry, I was on mute. Do we have questions from the committee? All right, we will move on to Anthony Smith from the NFIB.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you see me and hear me okay?
Let's see. There, I can see you now. Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony Smith. I'm the Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business, representing thousands of small businesses across the state, many being the smallest of small businesses, with about 90% of our members in Oregon having fewer than 25 employees and about 70% having fewer than 10 employees. Madam Chair, I signed up to testify as neutral on Senate Bill 137, and we are neutral on the bill as it was introduced. However, we have significant concerns with those Dash 1 amendments, which will be the focus of my testimony today. In response to the coronavirus pandemic, the United States Congress recognized financial hardships families and businesses have experienced because of sudden job losses and business closures by the passage of the CARES Act with overwhelming bipartisan support. Among other provisions, the CARES Act authorized economic impact payments, the otherwise known as stimulus checks, for individuals and made significant reforms to the federal tax code to provide tax relief to businesses. Both policies sought to address that core problem of reduced cash flow and liquidity. As the committee heard from the CPAs yesterday, normally, Oregon automatically connects to the federal tax code. The Dash 1 amendments to SB 137 would change that standard practice, making Oregon businesses ineligible for state-level tax relief that would otherwise flow their way. The Dash 1 amendments divert much-needed cash from the pockets of struggling small businesses to state coffers, making it harder for small businesses to keep their doors open and put unemployed Oregonians back to work. The Dash 1 amendments would disconnect Oregon from three parts of the CARES Act, which you've heard from explained by LRO staff, the business loss limitation provision, the net operating loss provision, and the business interest limitation provision. Passing a bipartisan congressional vote, the combined effects of these features of the CARES Act allow for the immediate monetization of business losses rather than having to carry losses forward to future tax years, and also allows for an increased deduction for interest paid, recognizing that many businesses have had to borrow in order to ride out the pandemic. The primary purpose of these provisions is to address liquidity in a time when most businesses are experiencing challenging cash flow issues. If Senate Bill 137 with the dash ones becomes law, the state would deny much needed tax relief to thousands of Oregon businesses totaling $83.9 million in the current biennium and $32.6 million for the 21-23 biennium, based on the best available figures I've seen produced by LRO to date. By the 23-25 biennium, this policy change would negatively impact the state budget by $25.4 million. With the future of the economic recovery still largely unknown, this could exacerbate future state budget holes, while it's still unclear whether the state will need to fill a budget hole for the 21-23 biennium, as talks of a relief package for the states continue between the Biden administration and the new Congress. By adopting the Dash One amendments, the state would be prioritizing its own possible budget needs over the immediate cash flow needs of Oregon businesses and the jobs that those businesses provide to working Oregonians. These businesses have been asked to play a critical role in stopping the spread of COVID-19. Many were required to shutter their doors. More have seen a drastic drop in sales, and nearly every business is now required to enforce public health and safety mandates. All of these factors have had a significant financial impact on Oregon's small businesses, and the last thing any of them need right now is a higher tax bill. So with that, NFIB respectfully asks you to protect Oregon businesses and the jobs Oregonians depend on by opposing the Dash One amendments to Senate Bill 137. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Madam Chair, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions? Okay, we will move on to JL Wilson. Welcome, JL.
Hi, thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, I'm JL Wilson, representing the Oregon State Chamber of Commerce. We would be opposed to the Dash One amendment, and that is the nature of my testimony. And just briefly, the CARES Act was really intended to leverage the tax code to create liquidity in what was basically a generational black swan economic event with enormous uncertainty, and none of us know or knew how this was going to unfold. And really, the CARES Act is about claiming tax benefits now instead of amortizing them over the next 5 years. And I would recommend that our businesses probably need the liquidity now with the higher level of uncertainty than amortized over the next 5 years. I wanted my comments to be focused primarily on the business loss limitation piece. I've seen a lot of the talking points on the bill, and certainly one of them is that the limits are high already at $500,000 per joint filing. And why would people at that income level need increased loss limitation? I think we're looking at it through the wrong lens, because, you know, we look at this as many of us as W-2 employees, and that this is, taxable wage income. But the business income, and I can speak from experience on this, and certainly from the feedback that I've gotten from our members, it is very, very common practice for business income to never actually leave the business, that it never actually goes into the bank account, if you will, of the shareholder. Oftentimes, shareholders pay themselves and are taxed as W-2 employees, but the business income that is taxed is often left in the company. I know that we do it. I know countless others do it. It's just a common practice. And lenders will certainly not want to lend if you're not don't have skin in the game and your own capital in your company. And so one of the reasons that money is left there is obviously for two reasons: for payroll and operational expenses, because those are ongoing and a taxable event. You still have to have money at the end of the day in the company, and that's why that money's left in. And also for capital investment and growth. And so for that reason, I think that there's a misnomer going that this money just automatically flows through to shareholder bank accounts, when in fact this money is largely left operational in businesses. So I think what gets lost is how many employees were able to generate taxable wages and income during this time due to the extra liquidity, and how much UI expenditure was averted because those same employees were not sent into the state's unemployment system. And that's a metric I think would really inform this discussion, but I'm sure that that is a robust metric because that's how business operates. And so that's why I'm particularly passionate about this particular provision. I also think on with respect to the business interest side, just understand, I know that this is for C corps with a high level of taxable income, 25 million, but just to understand that business interest is used to finance operations and investments in all these companies, including payroll, specifically in times when you're trying to keep your head above water in a contracting economy. So I just wanted to sound a note of caution, particularly on those two things, so you understand why our members would be opposed to the disconnect in the dash one. Thank you.
JL, do you have any data to back up your points on the business loss limitation? Because you're absolutely correct. On paper, it looks different from what you're describing. Do you have any data that you have available to show what you're saying is that most of that money is going back into the company?
Just experientially, and just because I run in those circles, I know that to be true, but I'd be curious if DOR or LRO had data. And I don't know that that would be available because they would probably keep track of tax receipts, but not necessarily know what happened to the net income. Did it flow through to the owner, or did it flow through to the back into the business? I suspect that would be hard to discern.
Okay, Chris, do you have anything to say on that before I take Senator Finley's question?
I think JL.
Or Kyle, I'm sorry.
I think JL hinted at it in that most of the information we have is the tax return. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the lens through which we get at. We could potentially talk to CPAs about general business practices and draw some maybe some examples there could help on kind of what a standard of practice is. We might be able to put that together.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful. Senator Finley, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me turn my arrow off before I forget. So I've just a recent check of OLIS, OBI and NFIB's testimony is not included. I assume I would ask that they provide written testimonies for the record because they had some pretty great testimony as well as Mr. Wilson.
Is that agreeable with you, JL?
Sure.
And Scott?
It is, thank you. Yeah, we just didn't even see this until this morning, so hence the slowness.
Now we have been publishing our agendas with plenty of notice.
I was, Madam Chair, that wasn't please don't take that as a critique. I'll just say I didn't see it till this morning, so.
Well, these are the challenges of the technology, and it is why we are trying to, err in the direction of too much notice. I just got a text while we were talking from someone who didn't know the hearing was taking place today. So we're all trying to figure our, navigate our way through these technological changes. So I'm glad the three of you were able to make it. Senator Finley, did you have more comments?
I do, Madam Chair, and as we discussed earlier, I have a critical appointment I have to be at in a little bit, so I wanted to put, if I could, in the past 2 days, we've heard from CPAs, OBI, NFIB, and Mr. Wilson on the extreme adverse impacts of the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 137. It hurts business cash flow when it's needed the most. Businesses don't need cash in 2 to 5 years. They need it now because we have shut them down. I believe it would be very detrimental to Oregon business if we adopt the Dash 1 amendment. So I thank you for the opportunity to have this discussion. I hope we have much more discussion before we get to the point of working through it. Thank you.
We will indeed. And good luck with your mission this afternoon.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if Kyle... I'm on an iPad and a phone, so I can't see. If Kyle is still there, I'd like to pose a question to Kyle, if that is possible.
That is possible. I see his bright, shining face right here. Kyle?
Kyle, just first as a statement of follow-up, as Chris had made mention, the CPAs should be able to shed light to LRO in regards to what are called owner distributions. because under the not one of them is going to file a tax return for a owner without seeing the ledgers, and the ledgers are going to tell them whether or not, even though it's not on the tax return, whether the owner is taking a distribution, say $1 million to fly off and buy a place in Tahiti, or whether they took $48,000 to pay the bills and the rest of it's still inside the business. So that's just a key point. But my question for future discussion here is, in basic regards outside of the business income, which is $25 million and above, and I'll stay out of that bailiwick, but the other two areas in combination in the amendment are in fact revenue neutral over time in combination, regardless. It's a matter of when you take the money. And the question also comes back to, we're sitting on a revenue forecast right now that frankly looks pretty good, especially if you're expecting a kicker check. And so I'm looking at this like I looked at in December when people were jumping up and down and saying, you better not, careful what you ask for, you might get it. Has there been revenue? Have you guys penciled some revenue forecast out here? Exactly how much additional revenue, for example, this would put in this biennium, which of course would go to the kicker most likely in the end if things hold steady state, and then how much revenue we're going to actually lose in each year's going forward, because what happens is we're going to lose revenue going forward because they're going to carry this forward. You guys just in the preliminary stages, Kyle, or you guys have some ballpark figures of these revenue forecasts? Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Boquist. So just echoing what Chris said earlier, it's trying to look into some of the information that may be out there about kind of these reinvestment of earnings or owner distributions, how you described it. We can see definitely what we can find out there from information that's not necessarily coming directly from the tax returns, but again, from outside research and those type of things, and see what we can learn about that and share that information. In terms of the revenue impact, and Chris can jump in at any time as well, this has been something we have been having conversations with the Office of Economic Analysis on since the start of the COVID epidemic back in the early spring, of just the initial forecast coming out, how to incorporate that into our estimates. And then moving forward, again, any of these disconnect provisions, the estimates and the timing of that is something we are looking into very hard. I mean, it is trying to keep track of that. It will depend in some cases on when these disconnect provisions, if they became enacted, when they become in effect. And that's something we've been working through over the course of the summer as well, of when the bill would be enacted and what that would mean for Oregon taxpayers. And especially in cases where we're talking of previous tax years and amending returns, there can be a timing element to this as well that we are definitely working through, and ongoing conversations between us, the Office of Economic Analysis, and the Department of Revenue as well, understanding how amended returns get processed and the timing of that.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes, Chris.
So just to add to that, the latest information we had that Kyle was referencing, we shared with the committees in early December, and I believe it was Anthony that referenced some of those numbers. It's a little one or two pager, and we can share with the committee. That was an update on these three provisions compared to our May report on the CARES Act. So
that's excellent. If you could share that, I think that's what is being requested here.
Will do.
Senator Wagner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to first say how much I appreciate the testimony that was provided, and especially to staff's wonderful overview and education. A couple just brief comments and food for thought as we go forward. This is the first full legislative session that we've had since CARES was passed in March, and I know there's been subsequent conversations about tax law changes. So this really is, outside of the special sessions that we've had, the first opportunity that we've been able to engage in true deliberative conversation about what this might mean to connect or reconnect from provisions of the federal tax code. I do want to note, because there was a little bit of an intimation that somehow this is going to land in a partisan conversation, which I don't think any of us are necessarily surprised of. But I do want to point out that five states, Colorado, Georgia, Hawaii, New York, and North Carolina, two of those states actually, I think, have Republican control in both the House and the Senate, and they have decoupled their tax laws from the Federal CARES Act. So I just want to note that
in other states where they're having these intentional conversations, that people are finding bipartisanship and coming together. And the last thing that I would like to say is that I spent a lot of time in Ways and Means during previous legislative sessions, had a chance to serve on the Human Services Subcommittee, co-chair the General Government Subcommittee, and then was on full. Thank you, Senator Burdick, for pulling me in and being able to expand my brain in a little bit of a different way here with the Revenue Committee, so I'm still learning my way in. But I know from my service in Ways and Means that as we look at wildfire recovery, the challenges that our schools are facing, housing, healthcare, COVID relief, and helping our small businesses and all of our communities in terms of helping them and their employees get back on their feet. I wish there was such a thing called a free lunch, but unfortunately there isn't. So I'm hoping that we'll have an opportunity to have this bill back up for public hearing to hear some of the other folks that might be able to express some of their opinion as well.
We will indeed. We're moving slowly in this process just in general because of the technological changes. And so this is not the last time we will be considering this issue. And thank you for bringing that up, Senator Wagner. Chris, I wanted to ask you, we have information about the PPP program. We're running, if we could, would it be timely and would it be germane in right now to just do the overview of that information?
Madam Chair, yeah, I think it would just take a few minutes. There are a couple, I think there's a personal example and a corporate example. I think Kyle and then Kate, we're gonna do to those. And it is tied to the testimony from yesterday, not the CARES Act, it was the bill that passed at the end of December. So that's right. Why it's a separate, yeah.
Yeah, and this is the bill that allows companies to define their forgiven loans as tax-free and also lets them deduct expenses from it. So I said that kind of clumsily, but I hope it got across. So why don't you go ahead, Chris, just to introduce us to that. And Senator Finley, you probably have to leave, but I just wanted to at least get started on this.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and I do have to leave. And thank you so much. I appreciate that. I assume there's no meeting tomorrow since the agenda is vacant for tomorrow.
Tomorrow, it's just a possible bill introduction. And as of this moment, I'm not aware of any bills that the committee needs to introduce, Madam Chair.
Okay, so you're right, Senator Finley.
Yeah, thank you. Since we're less than 24 hours, so I make that assumption, but thank you. I'll visit with you later. Have a good day.
Thank you, take care. Okay, Chris.
I don't know, I'm just gonna hand it off to Kyle and Kate. I'm not sure which one of them is gonna go first.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Chris. So we'll try to do this rather briefly and dive into one more set of examples here. I'll see if I can get this shared one more time. Okay, so for those that are following through OLIS as well, this is in the media materials and is titled Paycheck Protection Program Tax Examples. So I'll go ahead and pull that up. Okay, so again, these examples are just meant to try to help describe, I guess, the conversation that occurred yesterday with the CPAs, and exactly as you were mentioning, Madam Chair, is the Paycheck Protection Program and the deductibility of those expenses and the reporting of the income and how that works. So again, sometimes it's just easier to see a pretty simplified example just to hopefully give some overview of exactly how these pieces fit together. So what I have for you is an example on the personal income tax, and then Kate can discuss how this affects on the corporate income tax side of things, because there's a little bit of a difference there or a little bit of a nuance. So moving to this personal income tax example, we have, this is set up to show current law in this case, which would be including the recent changes at the federal level in late December from the Consolidated Appropriations Act, which stated that these expenses that are deducted or the expenses associated with a loan that's potentially forgiven through the PPP become deductible expenses. So just as a very brief overview of what the PPP is, and this is somewhat ongoing, the process, but you looking back to the summer, a business could apply for a loan, and that proceeds of that loan would be used to cover payroll and some other expenses that would be qualified expenses. And if the business does that and fulfills kind of its the requirements of the PPP loan, the business could then apply for that loan to be forgiven. And so the legislation that created this at the federal level, right from the get-go, said if a loan is forgiven, that's not going to be included as income. So that's, there hasn't been any question really on that going forward. That's been in law since the beginning. What was questionable, and the CPAs brought this up, was, okay, well, normally if you have a loan that's forgiven, there's no income in this case through the law, then what do you do with the expenses that you used with the loan proceeds? Would you count those as business expenses, or would you not count those as deductible business expenses because it was more or less the forgiven loan that flowed through to cover those expenses? And so what the IRS did is they, after the law passed, they put out notices saying, well, we look at this, and in the case of where the loan's forgiven, these expenses wouldn't be deductible in this case. Now, there was debate of whether that fit legislative intent, but in some cases, that's beside the point of how it was actually going to be administered, as the IRS and the Treasury Department at the federal level said, well, no, these expenses, they're not going to be deductible if the loan is going to be forgiven. So in late December, as part of that Consolidated Appropriations Act, a very large piece of legislation, I think 2,000 pages at the federal level, part of that was saying, well, no, we are going to make sure that these expenses, even if the loan is forgiven, are deductible. And so the example we have here is kind of trying to show how that works its way through and what the potential implications are. So under the current law, we have a loan amount of $200,000, and we're saying the expenses that are funded are equal to that $200,000. So the money comes in, and it goes right back out to cover those qualified expenses. In this case, there's no reported income, and the expenses that could be deducted would be that $200,000. So the business doesn't report a positive $200,000 income for the forgiven loan, but they can take that deduction, and that's the change in taxable income here of negative $200,000. The business is getting to use those expenses. By deducting that, assuming the business has tax liability and everything, they could have a benefit here of, in this case, in this example, $67,000, in that they can use, that's the value of those expenses being deducted and lowering their income to the business and when they file their taxes. So before the Consolidated Appropriations Act, and this was under the guidance of the rules that the Treasury and the IRS were putting out, the reported income, again, as I said, that was never really under question. That was clearly in law that a forgiven loan wouldn't be included in this case. But the IRS was saying, well, you can't deduct the expenses. If the loan's forgiven, you can't deduct these expenses. And in that case, you have the loan come in, you don't deduct the expenses, and it kind of trues it up there to zero change in the taxable income. So there's no real direct benefit then to the taxpayer in the terms of the expenses, because it's offsetting equally to the fact that there's no income reported, then the expenses don't get reported. And so again, similar to what you saw in the previous examples, from an Oregon disconnect, it doesn't change anything at the federal level. So in this case, the taxpayer could still get that $50,000 benefit at the federal level from still deducting those expenses. But in this case, and this was in the discussion as well with the CPAs, Oregon would disconnect from this provision. So how Oregon decided to do that, that would still be certainly up to discussion. CPAs and the committee talked through this, where it could be limiting those expenses and the deductibility of those, or requiring an inclusion of the income, if it is forgiven, would be another way to disconnect. So there could be potential ways forward for Oregon to say, we don't want to connect to this recent provision at the federal level. But in either way, you would more or less just take it back to where it was before the Consolidated Appropriations Act and the recent law change, and it would be in line with what the IRS was saying they were going to administer the law as prior to the change in December. So it would more or less put it back to a balanced approach, if you will. You don't include the loan proceeds and income, then you don't take the expenses from a business standpoint. So you still get the federal benefit, and it would zero out the potential benefit here in Oregon.
Okay, and the CPAs made the point that this would be complicated because the expenses often occur in a different tax year than the forgiven loan. And so it's really hard to true them up. If we did make an attempt to disconnect from this, would we have the leeway, for example, to maybe allow the expenses, but to have the forgiven loans count as income if they were above, say, a certain threshold? Would we have the ability to set some kind of a floor and disconnect for businesses that are doing well and keep the double benefit in place for the smaller struggling businesses? Would that be something we could consider?
Yes, Madam Chair, I think that could be a provision exactly as focusing on the income when it's actually forgiven. Yeah, that would be one way to tailor the policy. And you make an excellent point. In this example, we don't show it over two different years. It's kind of all at the same time, but that's a very good point. And I think the CPA's brought that up as well, with, in many cases, the expenses were last year in 2020, and the forgiveness could very well happen this year in 2021.
Yeah.
But yes.
Okay. Questions from the committee? This is going to be an interesting road we're traveling, and we will be discussing this further. So I want to thank the staff for your excellent and clear presentations today. This really was a very helpful way to look at the situation. And thank the committee members. And Chris, do we have any more business before we go?
Madam Chair, I believe that concludes your business for the day.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
Yeah, Madam Chair, could we ask staff to do a little homework on options of timing in regards to, and maybe a little bit of future briefing, so everybody's reminded that we are quite partisan in Oregon because we only have the income tax. Doesn't have to do about party affiliation. We are in the mountains, as Senator Hass and I used to, in fact, the Swiss Alps. we don't have a sales tax as high as 11.2%. We're kind of stuck what we have. And the timing of this is going to be critical, Madam Chair, because anything, all the proposals we've seen right now or we're discussing, which I'm fully in favor of discussing and coming up with plans, the one thing we got to be careful of is that what I've seen so far actually decreases income in the out bienniums.
Correct.
All across the board. We need to be very careful because I think we're going to need money next biennium in all kinds of forms. And we'll be talking about how to increase revenue, no doubt. And so the timing of it and that impact, and frankly, what maybe have a better idea, I think it's February 20th or something, Chris has said previously, when we have the next revenue forecast. But that's something to keep in mind, that we might be getting, we don't want to shoot ourselves in the foot, so to speak, for our future revenues.
That's correct. And you raised a very good point, too, about the impacts on a potential kicker. And I think we will know more. We'll be flying a little less blind after the March forecast, which is coming out at the end of February.
On the 24th.
On the 24th. Thank you for bringing that up, Senator Broquist. Okay. With that, committee, I think we're done with our business, and we are adjourned.